Welcome to the Lost Gardens of Heligan podcast, Beauty in All Things. I'm Alistair Moore, Head of Gardens and Estate, and each month we'll be revealing the inner workings of life at Heligan in all its glory, from soil to seeds, bulbs to bees, past, present and future. All from right here in the Lost Gardens of Heligan on the Cornish coast. In this episode, I'll be talking to Katie, our supervisor of productive gardens, in the cosy confines of the head gardener's office. And I'll be walking the walls of the flower garden with head of gardens, Nicola. This morning, I am very fortunate to be in the head gardener's office, which is a small but elegantly fitted out room just behind the walls to the flower garden. There's a crackling fire in the hearth, and most importantly of all, I'm joined by Katie from the productive garden. Hello, Katie.
Hi, Alistair.
Good morning, Katie. Could you say a little bit about who you are, what you do, and how long you've been working at Heligan?
Yep. So my name's Katie and I'm productive garden supervisor. So you'll find me in the kitchen garden, melon yard or flower garden. And I started at Heligan back in 2015.
Beautiful. Katie, you've come armed with a jar of seeds. Could you tell me a little bit about what they are, please?
Absolutely. Yes. So I've brought some of our crimson flowered broad beans with me. It won't be long, probably February and March, that we'll start sowing some of our broad beans. So I thought it was a good place to start. And the crimson flowered one is a really special one because it's one that we've previously saved at Heligan as well.
So Katie, you've got a magnificent Kilner jar full of beans. Would you be very kind and just open it for us, please?
Yeah.
So these are fairly standard looking desiccated beans. They sort of, I don't know, they almost look like kind of oversized pistachios or something, but they've got a very satisfying rattle to them. Katie, remind me, which variety of broad bean is this?
So you've got the crimson flower broad bean. It was really popular in the 1700s, but thought to be extinct at one point until kind of mid-1970s. An elderly lady sent in about 4 crimson flower broad beans to the Heritage Seed Library.
Wow. So all of this has come from 4 beans.
I assume so. We have really strong links with the Heritage Seed Library, especially sort of 30 years ago when the gardens were being restored and we were looking for heritage varieties that were difficult to source. And when I first joined Heligan, sort of 2015, it was November, so wintry. And one of my first jobs I remember was podding some of our crimson flowered broad beans that had been saved that year.
Oh, lovely. So meaningful for you in many ways. Just remind me a bit about the Heritage Seed Library and what they do.
Yeah, so I think they were founded back in sort of 1975, and it was to gather together really tricky to source kind of ex-commercial varieties that hadn't, I suppose, been taken forward in modern times. And the great thing is that they have, I suppose, a living library of seed really, which they then share with their members. And we are seed guardians for them as well, kind of on an annual basis. So we've grown things like peas, French beans and tomatoes, which we sent back to them that they can share with their members.
Fantastic. So how old are these beans? Are they this year's crop?
No, not this year's crop. So this, I suppose, the crimson flowered is a success story in that it is now commercially available. So it's not one we need to save every year, but it is one we've got our eye on in terms of our seed stock and making sure it's still viable in case we want to reach for it in the future. It's one that we grow generally in the garden, but with your broad beans, they do need to be isolated because otherwise they'll have a tendency to crop with other varieties of broad beans.
So just to be clear, meaning that if you were growing this bean for seed, we couldn't just grow it out with the other broad beans in the kitchen garden. We have to isolate it.
Yeah, ideally moving forward, that would be something we do. Within the kitchen garden, it was grown away from other broad beans at the time. And then also there were lots of other crops kind of in between, I suppose. Yeah. So hopefully that limited any issues there. But yeah, moving forward, that would be something to look at is preventing cross-pollination.
When was this seed potted?
Well, 2014 seems to be a vintage year in our seed store. So when we do our viability testing, which is kind of every 3 years or so, we found that 2014, whatever it is, whether it's a French bean, a broad bean, peas, things that were saved, come up with at least 90, if not 100% viability. Wow. At the moment for germination.
Any idea why in particular that year?
Not really. I think maybe it was a combination of really good sort of drying season.
Yeah.
We found now, more recently, that we get a bit of a wetter end to the summer, which isn't great for kind of collecting in our seed. But I think it was probably a combination of great summer for drying seed and also maybe the processing, the drying process before they were stored as well.
And now, does that mean its future is secure?
You would hope so, but I don't think it's that straightforward. We noticed in COVID, we kind of become to rely on the fact that we could buy it in bulk. We have 100-foot rows, so it's a lot of seed that we want to use. But we found kind of during the COVID period, there'd actually been a crop failure. So that year, commercially, it was quite hard to get hold of, or it was only available in quite small amounts, which is where it's comforting to know we've got some really secure stock ourselves.
Absolutely. So there's still, even now, that sense of fragility of these lines, this sort of genetic lines.
Yeah, and I think that's where we try and make sure we haven't got just a single jar or something. So that's something our viability testing does, is tells us if we've got low germination rates or a really small amount of seed. That will really focus us in the following year as to what we prioritise for seed saving.
So with the viability, you say you test these seeds every 3 years. What's the sort of Katie Kingett kind of line in the sand that in terms of a percentage of viability?
I suppose 80% and upwards is ideal. 90% even better.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what we're aiming for.
And these red flower beauties, what sort of viability from 2014?
So
10 years ago.
Yeah, they've got 100% viability.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing about the 2014 summer.
Well, I just love the thought that all of these, you know, there's probably a few hundred beans in that magnificent jar, and every one of them is just raring to go, given the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, typically you'd expect perhaps pea or bean seed to kind of save for at least 3 to 4 years well in good conditions. But the fact that, yeah, this is still going strong a decade later is brilliant.
Amazing. So on a very practical level, this season, should I wish to have a crop of these delicious items, how would I go about that? When should I sort of...
Yeah, I mean, really February, March maybe would be good times to sow these. They grow to about 3 or 4 feet high, the plants themselves, and then ornamentally, they're just really beautiful.
Yeah.
With their crimson flowers, something a little unusual, I suppose, to spot in the garden, and they taste really good too. The pods are a little bit shorter than perhaps some other varieties. You probably get about 4 beans or so in a pod, but yeah, the taste makes up for that.
And that classic heritage kind of trade-off of flavour and quite possibly nutrition, because we know how closely nutrition and flavour are linked with productivity, is that's the absolute kind of go-to. So at Heligan, how do we grow these? Do we put them in a seed tray? Do we direct sow them?
Yeah, so these we would direct sow. We'd probably do a double row. We might sow a few more than we need just so we can thin out. And then if we have any casualties with mice, they often kind of like them just as they're emerging. So that's one for us to keep an eye on. And then, yeah, we'd thin them down to about 9 inches per plant in the row. And we give them a little bit of support as well, some post and wires.
Yeah. And when would you be expecting to harvest them?
Probably around July, yeah, I think, depending on when we sowed them.
And what is your favourite way to eat the crimson bean?
For me, it's definitely the most tender beans. The first ones of the seasons are my favourite. And if you've managed to overwinter some peas as well, so you can have kind of spring, maybe broad beans and peas in a risotto, is really delicious.
Oh, God. Oh, you're making me hungry now. Well, fantastic. And thinking about this year, are there any seeds in particular that you're interested in saving?
Yeah, I mean, the crimson broad bean, we've got enough stock at the moment that we don't need to grow it this year. but the Martock,
right,
which dates back to the 12th century.
Good heavens.
A village in Somerset. That is one that we've only got one jar of.
Right.
It's got decent viability, but I'd feel happier if we had a couple of jars. So probably our best bet is to grow it down in the nursery where we can isolate it better from other broad beans that we're growing this year.
Wow. 12th century bean. Now we're talking. That's brilliant. Well, Katie, I don't know about you, but I'm just going to sit by the fire for a little bit longer and contemplate the wonder of beans. But thank you so much. That's absolutely fascinating. And I'm sure 2024 will be a bumper year for the Martock as well as everything else. But thank you so much, Katie. That was brilliant.
Okay, thank you.
It is the most beautiful January morning. We've just had a little flurry of snow, but the clouds have all disappeared and it's now clear blue sky. It's probably about 0 degrees. The sun is shining. It's a low sun and it's catching the limbs of our beautiful rhododendrons with a gorgeous soft light. And it is the limbs of the rhododendrons in particular that we're going to be talking about today in conjunction with the flower garden wall. And it is the flower garden wall that we're going to be talking about today. And I am joined by no other than the marvellous Nicola, our head gardener. Hello, Nicola.
Hello, Alistair.
And Nicola, we're looking at the wonderful 18th century brick of the flower garden walls and the splendid limbs of the rhododendrons. What is the connection?
The limbs are connecting with the wall.
They are, aren't they?
They are, yeah. So it's something that we've been aware of for quite some time. We've been kind of looking and, you know, monitoring what's going on with this, but I think recently we've had quite a thorough survey done of the whole system of walls throughout the northern gardens and the productive areas, and it really is a sort of we've got to the stage now where I think we need to take some action to ensure the future of both the rhododendrons and the walls. So this is our plan for the coming month.
And it is something that we've slightly put off because we're down in the area of Sikkim, which has some of the oldest and grandest of our rhododendrons, and it's named Sikkim after the area sort of borders of India and the Himalayas where the seed for these beautiful specimens was originally collected. But what's our hesitancy has been based upon what in terms of dealing with this?
What you described earlier, I mean, the absolute beauty of this space right now with all these intertwining limbs and the light that casts, and when it rains, the beautiful kind of colours of all of that. So it's something that we've become really known for is our beautiful rhododendron collection, and that's what people enjoy coming through, these rhododendrons that you wouldn't normally see like this, probably growing out in the wild, left to their own devices, but very rarely do you see such beautiful big old specimens growing in this unruly way. And, you know, so I think we personally feel very much that we love them and we would like to manage them. You know, horticulturally, probably the best thing to do with most of them would be to do some severe pruning, chop them right back, let them regenerate. But of course, as gardeners and also our regular visitors, and I think everybody who knows Heligan well would be absolutely horrified if we did that.
Quite right.
It's not what we want to do. It's kind of that striking a balance between managing the rhododendrons for their future health and longevity, but also maintaining what is that very special atmosphere of walking through these sort of twisted, amazing, beautiful structures that the stems create.
No, absolutely. And of course, they are limbs, and some of them are sort of thicker than a shot putter's thigh, and they are actually resting on the sort of coping, the top of this ancient and listed wall, and really delivering quite a payload of pressure and wear and tear as a result. The other side of the matter, when we're looking at it from inside the flower garden rather than outside as we are now, when they're in flower, it just looks amazing, doesn't it?
It is. It's beautiful. I mean, it's just this real sort of cascade of sort of flowers and foliage cascade over the walls and into the garden. It's a really important part of that interior sort of the flowers and the display that you see inside the flower garden. It's really added to by the rhododendrons being there, so it would feel a great loss to not have them there.
No, absolutely. So what are we going to have to do, Nicola?
So we are going to take some of the plant growth away, and then we are also going to do some serious propping to lift and remove the weight off the wall. So I think it's like any of these things, when you look at it, it just looks like such a tangle and such a jigsaw. But when you actually get in there and you start looking at the limbs and what's going where and what's sitting on top of each other, I think you can start to see which limbs are the ones that you need to take out and which limbs will be staying. So it's going to be a mixture of treatments, some removal carefully and considered, and also some propping. And the beauty of the rhododendrons is if we do remove some of the limbs, then we can use those limbs to prop some of the others as well. So you still can have them here as part of the tangle of stems. And we'll try and do that as much as we can, because I think visitors, if they know Heligan and wander the gardens regularly, will see that that's quite often what we do with trees when they start to get old and need a little bit of an extra hand, then quite often we use trees.
Yeah, no, well, it's a sort of holistic / cannibalistic approach to things. And of course, it means that the props are absolutely in keeping.
Yes, absolutely. So when you look up here and that beautiful view that you see of the limbs now really quite low across the path, you have to duck through and twist your way along. That should still, you know, you should still see that. You shouldn't be trying to do it in a sensitive way that won't ruin that walk up through here.
Wonderful. So we'll be working on that in the next few months. But there's another form of attack that the walls are under, not this time from plants, but from birds. Maybe we should go and have a look at that. We'll take a stroll into the flower garden itself.
Yeah, okay, let's head that way.
Well, we're now come out from the dappled shade of Sikkim to the, quite frankly, blinding sunshine of the flower garden. And it is, despite being a really cold day, gosh, sitting in the sun here, you really understand, you know, what the benefits of a sheltered walled garden, which is exactly where we are, Nicola. Could you tell me a bit more about the flower garden walls?
Yeah, so, I mean, they're absolutely beautiful walls. They're so characterful, and they're the earliest part of the productive garden. So these walls date from about 1780.
Wow.
And they're not actually made of a local brick. They are Flemish. So for many hundreds of years, we were importing Flemish bricks because they were known to be a sort of a better quality.
Quality.
Yeah, so I think it was much later in the sort of 1800s when we increased our sort of production to make a sort of a higher standard of brick. So they were the preferred brick to use. So not so many miles up the road is St Austell. And that area from sort of mid-1700s were producing, mining and exporting china clay. And that would go off in ships to the potteries in Belgium and the Netherlands, and then coming back on the ships back to Cornwall would be the Flemish bricks.
Wow.
And so they would be used around the local area to build. There's quite a lot of buildings around this area that are built from Flemish bricks, and our walls are so a sort of a testament to the quality and the longevity of those bricks.
Absolutely.
So very old. And again, like you say, very characterful, but I mean, really have amazingly stood the test of time. Because as you say, they bake. If you walk in here, they bake in the midday sun, in the middle of the summer. It's absolutely baking. You've got the Cornish salt winds and the damp and, you know,
hundreds of years they've stood here, and they're still standing.
And as you say, they look magnificent. There's a sort of mottled effect of the, you get the red of the brick and then the sort of creamy greens of lichen, and they really are, it's a little work of art. But there's a slightly extraordinary patch of the wall immediately behind us. This is a section that the other side of this wall, the old bothy. But Nicola, I wonder if you could just describe what's happened here.
So these walls are very popular with the bird population. So if you sit for any length of time and watch, you'll see all the birds sort of coming in and they're pecking away and taking the grit from the walls. And even in, you know, my time, it's quite dramatic. I think that more and more so now, I guess, as the walls become looser, it's probably easier to get to. And so there are now really some quite serious holes in the wall. But you can see, if you look to the right of this wall, you can see there's the rendering on the wall next to it. So there were a glasshouse range running along here, and these walls were obviously rendered and under glass. So all the rendering has come off this wall now, and it's really very exposed. And again, you know, just looking at it, it's time to take some kind of quite radical action to ensure that we conserve it for the future. And the idea is that in the not too distant future, we would love to reinstate part of that glasshouse range and have a lovely lean-to glasshouse structure back up against this wall. So, but until that time, we need to protect. So we've been advised to cover it and just kind of put batten supports on it, keep it covered and protected until we're ready to reconstruct that glasshouse. And then, like I say, we can consolidate the wall, render it again, and it'll be back to its fully functioning sort of purpose. And I'm sure we'll be growing lots of lovely things up it in the not too distant future. And again, you know, so obviously we're all, as gardeners, we all love our wildlife and our birds, and we're quite worried about the fact that the birds aren't going to have anything to to peck at. So, you know, we will be putting in some little baths of grit and crushed up bricks nearby so that they can still come and get their essential minerals that they get from the wall. So hopefully the wall and the birds will all come out of it well.
What a harmonious approach that is. I love it. I'm just sort of standing up to turn around, have a look at the run of the wall. And we were talking about the history and, you know, dating back to the late 18th century. And it's amazing just to look, as you say, there's the render. There's some evidence of cement pointing, which was done much later. It kind of tells a bit of a tale of the history of the gardens itself. And one of our old great survivors is the fig, which is against the wall, which once upon a time was probably in the glasshouse.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that we let it grow much more kind of wild now, but that would have been, yes, contained within the glasshouse. Again, as you say, the story of the walls, there's so many stories. And when you look into it here and in the melon yard as well, you look at the walls where the fruit's been trained on them for many years. And also, what if you look closely, you'll see many tiny little regular sort of holes within render on the walls. And that's from all the years of training fruit trees on them. So it wasn't until about the 1850s that wire was mass produced. So previous to that time, and bearing in mind how old our walls are, how long fruit would have been grown on them before then, they would have used strips of fabric and nails to train the trees to the walls. So again, when you start looking, the story there of, as time and technology moved on and the different ways of carrying out those tasks, you know, so there's it's just lovely to see that timeline, and they do tell a great story.
Well, and there's another layer to that timeline when our redoubtable maintenance team start work on the wall in front of us. So we'll look forward to that. And as you say, just adding another layer to the deep strata of stories that we enjoy at Heligan. Nicola, thank you so much. That was fascinating.
Thank you. Thanks, Alistair.
Cheerio. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Lost Gardens of Heligan podcast, Beauty in All Things. If you enjoyed it, do like and subscribe, and I look forward to you joining us again for our next episode.